Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
If your motives are bad, God will deal with you, but at least the gospel is being preached. But let's remember what Paul wrote in some of his other letters, like Galatians, where he attacked a false gospel. Paul said, if you preach a false gospel, I don't care how good your motives are. You're dangerous, and you got to stop preaching your false gospel. Your good motives don't excuse your false message. Well, listen, Paul's imprisonment could not hinder the gospel, but neither could the wrong motives of some people. God's work was still getting done.
The Apostle Paul encouraged the Philippians to preach the gospel. Now, some would say that in order to preach the gospel, one needs to have the mind and heart of Christ. But in today's message, Pastor David explains that as long as the gospel of the Lord is being preached, it doesn't matter what the motives are of the one spreading the news. God will work things out. However, no good can come about if a false gospel is being spread. So we must speak truth and allow God to do the rest. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
You know, I like Paul's attitude. He says, if you preach the true gospel, I don't care what your motives are. If your motives are bad, God will deal with you, but at least the gospel is being preached. But let's remember what Paul wrote in some of his other letters, like Galatians, where he attacked a false gospel. Paul said, if you preach a false gospel, I don't care how good your motives are. You're dangerous, and you got to stop preaching your false gospel. Your good motives don't excuse your false message. Well, listen, Paul's imprisonment could not hinder the gospel, but neither could the wrong motives of some people. God's work was still getting done, and that's why Paul's rejoicing there at verse 18. So look at his great confidence here, starting at verse 19. He says how confident he is in the present circumstances. He says, for I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed. But with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. I love Paul's certainty there. Verse 19, I know that this will turn out for my deliverance. Paul knew that the Lord was in control of all events, even though his imprisonment and impending trial before Caesar Nero made this whole situation look pretty dark. And notice what he connects his deliverance with. His deliverance is connected with their prayer. This will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer. He was confident because he knew that the Philippians were praying for him. His deliverance was connected to the prayer of the Philippians. So let me throw out a hypothetical before you. What if the Philippians stopped praying? Couldn't you say that Paul says, whoa, I don't know now. You stop praying. Who knows how this might go? I was confident before, but now you stop praying, and now I wonder. It's amazing how much God puts upon prayer. God forbid that we ever adopt that sort of fatalistic attitude. You know, listen, you know, what God's going to do, he's going to do. He's just planned it all out ahead of time, and there's nothing for us to do. And so, you know, yeah, I'll pray for fellowship with God, but it's not like prayer actually ever changes anything because God's got his plan, right? I'll tell you what, you read this right here. And as far as Paul was concerned, if the Philippians prayed, he would be delivered. If they didn't, he's not so sure. He connected his deliverance with their prayer. Matter of fact, not only the prayer, though, I love how he words this here in verse 19. I know that this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. You might say Paul recognized that it wasn't the prayer in itself that did it. It was the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. But what sent the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ? It was prompted by the prayers of the Philippians. And therefore, he says, my earnest expectation and hope that in nothing I will be ashamed, but with all boldness, as always so now, Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. Now, notice this. Paul, in verse 19, is talking about deliverance, right? For I know that this will turn out for my deliverance. And as the Philippians hear that, they go, oh yeah, deliverance. Paul knows he's going to be released from prison. And then at the end of verse 20, he says, whether by my life or my death. And they realize, whoa, he means deliverance in two ways, right? He could be delivered from prison and walk out a free man, or he could be delivered from the bonds of this earth and walk as a free man into heaven. Paul says, I don't care. Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. That's all I really care about. I know that Jesus Christ is going to be magnified. Now, this leads Paul in now into verse 21, into one of the most dramatic statements that he makes, even though it hit hard upon the Philippians. I mean, they saw God work so many remarkable miracles of deliverance in Paul's life among them, yet Paul's admitting to them, you know what? God may not deliver me from this. Can't we say that there's really two ways that God delivers? Sometimes God delivers us from our problems, and sometimes he delivers us through our problems. Well, in Philippi, he was delivered from jail. Here, Paul's saying, I don't know if it's going to be from or through, but I'll be delivered. I know that. Then he goes on in this passage that I hope you've read it before. I hope these words sound familiar to you because they're some of the most glorious in the New Testament. He says here, starting in verse 21, for me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I cannot tell. For I'm hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you for all your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again. We just kind of take a pause and a second look at that triumphant statement in verse 21, right? For me to live is Christ and to die is gain. You see, Paul knew that death was not a defeat to the Christian. It was merely a graduation to glory. It's a net gain for the Christian. And Paul's death at the time would be a gain in two senses. First of all, his death for the cause of Christ would glorify Jesus, and that's gain. Second, Paul would be in the immediate presence of the Lord, and that would be gain for Paul. Paul says, for me to die is gain. Now let me ask you, what can the world do to such a man? To such a man who says, to live is Christ, to die is gain. What is the world going to do to him? So the terrorist comes and holds a knife to his throat and says, unless you convert to Islam, we're going to kill you. And a man like Paul says, hey, to live is Christ, to die is gain. You can't do anything to me. It's a win-win situation. The world can do nothing to such a man. Oh, no. We're going to make your life a living hell then. Paul says, no, I got that covered. You see, to live is Christ. And wherever Christ is, it's not a living hell. I'm with him. So if I live, I'm with Christ. If I die, I gain. You can do nothing to me. By the way here, the idea that Paul would consider death a present gain argues against two doctrines. It argues against the doctrine of soul sleep. Some people believe that when you die, you sort of go into a state of suspended animation and hang out there for 20, 40,000, whatever years until you're resurrected and then you go to heaven. No. Paul would have said, to live is Christ, to die is to sleep with my soul until Jesus brings me home. No. It also argues against another doctrine, and that's the doctrine of purgatory. Paul would have said, to live is Christ, to die is to go to purgatory for however many years until my soul goes from purgatory to heaven. No. Paul says, to live is Christ, to die is gain, and it shows that Paul did not fear death. I'll make a categorical statement here. No Christian should fear death. Now listen, it's one thing to fear dying. Right? I think of some poor believer, their body's racked with cancer, they're in terrible pain, they wonder if they're going to live a matter of days or a matter of weeks or a matter of months and how long the whole process will last out and the whole process of dying is upon them. And you know what? They fear the process of dying. Fearing dying is not the same as fearing death. And no believer should fear death, just like the Apostle Paul. Because we can say with Paul, to live is Christ, to die is gain. Now, the live part was clear. He says, if I live on in the flesh, that will mean fruit for my labor. Paul said, listen, if I live, it's going to be fruitful. Don't you wish every believer had that attitude? That's it. If I live, fruit is going to come forward. They know it. And then he goes on and says in this remarkable statement, verse 23, "For I'm hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better." Having a desire to depart and be with Christ. By the way, it's a very strong longing that Paul uses there, or describes there. The Greek word has a lot of force in it. It's almost as if he's panting. He's sighing. He's longing to depart. He desires to depart. I'm going to say something bold here. I hope I'm not going out too far. Could you not say here from verse 23 that Paul says that he wanted to die? I desire to depart. It's a very strong word he uses there for desire. He says, I want to die. Now listen, other men have also wanted to die. Some men wish to die because they're gripped by the gloom and the darkness that leads to suicide. Some men wish to die because they're so tired of this world and the cruelty of others that they think that death is better. Some men want to die because they're in the crisis of some kind of suffering and they think that death is better than their present suffering. I want you to know that Paul's desire to die, we can call it, had nothing in common with any of those. Paul's desire to depart had many motivations, and I'll just give you three. First of all, Paul said, you know, when I depart, when I go to heaven, I'm going to be done with sin and temptation. Doesn't that sound great? I mean, honestly, there's going to come a day when we're in heaven when we don't sin anymore, when we're not tempted anymore. And Paul says, oh, I want that. And then he says, going to heaven will mean that I'm going to see those brothers and sisters who have gone to heaven before me. You know, the longer I live and the more people that I know and that I have been close to have died, the more I think this is precious. I think of some dear saints that I've known in my day. I think of a man named Gene, an old man who was part of my congregation back in California and one of our elders and just an amazing, amazing godly man. And you know, when I think that Gene is in heaven, I say, heaven is more dear to me now because he's there. And I want to see Gene again. I think of another man named Tony. Tony wasn't particularly old, and he died very suddenly. And you know what? Tony, man, I can't wait to go to heaven and see Tony. And I think of friends and relatives, and I think of dear people who have gone before, and I say heaven is dear because of that. And then thirdly, most importantly, you saw what he said right there in verse 23, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ. Isn't that it most of all? I mean, heaven's going to be great because no more sin and no more temptation. Heaven's going to be great because we're going to get to see those people that have gone on before us. But most of all, the surpassing glory of heaven will be Christ himself, closer and better than ever before. And so he says, I've got a desire to depart. You know, it's great. This whole metaphor that he uses, the language that he uses here, seems to be the language of a ship where he says, you know, here I am. I'm in harbor. I'm in a foreign port. The ship is in a foreign port, and I want to strike the sail and go home. And I want to depart. I'm just waiting. I don't belong in this port. You know, I'm here. I know all that, and the ship is being useful here. But when am I going to get to strike the sail and go on the voyage and go home to my home port? Matter of fact, Paul knew this too, that it wouldn't be a long journey, right? You don't have to sail a long way to get home. No, he would strike the sail and then it would be like that miraculous boat ride that the disciples had on the Sea of Galilee. As soon as Jesus stepped in the boat, bam, they were at their destination. And that's how it would be for Paul. So Paul says, yes, I desire this. But then look at what he says in verse 24. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. You see, Paul understood that other people still needed him, that his work was not yet done. And so he allowed for the possibility of his martyrdom. He told the Philippian Christians that he expected to be spared at this time. He said, I know that I shall remain and continue with you, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again. Paul said, you know, I know when we see each other again, it's going to be great. And you want to know how it turned out? Did Paul die? Did he ever get back to see the Philippians? Yes, he did. Paul's friendship with the Philippians was close, and he survived this imprisonment. He was set free. He was martyred again at Rome years later, but he did visit the Philippians again. Now, Paul's in prison. The Philippians are in Philippi, not surprisingly. So how should they act when Paul's away? Now notice this, that's the last few verses that we're going to take a look at here tonight. Verse 27. He says, "Only let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind striving together for the faith of the gospel." Now look, isn't this great? Paul, I hope I'm not saying this the wrong way, but Paul was a master of psychology. I mean, his amazing, stirring words, "Live or die, it's all for Christ. I don't care. Kill me, or if I live, but I'll stay for your good. I love you, Philippians. I know it'll be for your good." And then he takes a breath and he says, "Now, I want you to act a certain way while I'm gone." And like the Philippians, when this is being read to them, they're fighting back the tears. They're like, "Oh, Paul, you would live or die for us, and you love us so much." And now they're just so ready to hear the instructions that he has for them. Now, I want you to notice this. What is his point in verse 27? If there was any problem in the Philippian church, what was the problem? They didn't have an exact unity. Maybe there was some quarreling, some squabbling, some fighting. Now, I want you to remember this very carefully, especially as we transition into chapter 2 the next time we're together, because that forms the whole foundation of that stirring passage in chapter 2. Paul's saying, "Let your conduct be worthy of the gospel, so that whether I come and see you or in absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel." You see, Paul says, "I want to hear that you're unified. I don't want to hear that there's divisions and squabbling and fighting and dissensions among you." No, I don't want to hear that at all. Now going on, now, just keep that in mind, because he's going to touch on that mightily into chapter 2. But now he's going on here, verse 28. "And not in any way terrified by your adversaries, which is to them a proof of perdition, but to you of salvation and that of God." Now, he says, listen, don't be terrified by your adversaries, because when you show courage in the face of your adversaries, it's to them a proof of perdition. Do you know what perdition is? It's destruction. When we show courage in the face of our enemies, it testifies to them that their judgment and their destruction is certain. They say, "Well, God is with this man. And if God is with him, he's not with me, because I'm opposing him." It's proof of their perdition. But notice what he says, "but to you of salvation." Your courage, your tenacity, your joy in the midst of trials. Now, I know this would be true in the midst of sufferings that we would go through today. Again, if you just want to paint a scenario, you know, paint the picture. Here's a person being, you know, threatened or tortured by terrorists or something like that. And they just show joy. They show no terror. They just show trust in Christ through it all. And listen, that would be powerful evidence to those people who are persecuting and torturing that person that their destruction is certain, and it would be testimony to them of their salvation. But I don't mean it just purely in a physical way. I think we can consider this too with our spiritual enemies. Think of the demons that are just waiting for you to get afraid, right? Afraid of the uncertainties in your life. Afraid of the temptations that have been or that will come. Afraid of this or afraid of that. And you just show courage and tenacity in the face of Jesus Christ. You know what those demons say? They say, "Man, we're going to hell. We're destined for destruction. And this guy's testifying to us of it." That's the idea here, that their courage is a warning, is a witness against those who oppose them. And now they have no reason to be terrified by their adversaries here. Verses 29 and 30, he says, "For to you it has been granted on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict which you saw in me, and now here is in me." All right, let's think about just these last few verses here. Paul has really pulled on the heartstrings of the Philippians, right? Telling about his own courage, his own willingness to face death, his own desire to see them. He has very effectively, not in a manipulative way, but in a very honest way, he's pulled on their heartstrings, and then he says, now I want you to hang together in unity. And what was it that seemed to be stressing out their unity? It seems that it was attacks from enemies. Probably they were being persecuted. Can you see the picture maybe going on in the Philippian church? Persecution starts coming up. Makes people afraid. It makes people angry and maybe a little bit short of temper with one another. It makes them willing to divide one against another. It makes them suspicious of one another. They want to know why you were persecuted, but you were not. Was there compromise there? Was there not compromise on the other side? What's going on? And there's division coming up, probably in the context of persecution. So Paul's saying, listen, don't worry about the persecution because, and he had to say, verse 29 and 30 are powerful. It has been granted on behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. You know, when you think of what God grants to you, right? God has a grant for you. Oh, really? Wonderful. What is it? Well, it is for you to believe in his name. Oh, great. I take that grant from God to believe in his name. God has another grant for you. Well, I want to receive it too. His grant is for you to suffer for his sake. Thanks, God, I think. Is this your gift to me? You see, they needed to understand that in the same way belief was granted to them, so also was the privilege to suffer for his sake. You see, that ancient Greek word there that's translated for suffer is the ancient Greek word pasco. It's most commonly used in the context of persecution, but not always. It's also used of physical sufferings that are not related to persecution. It's used of suffering under temptation, and it's used of hardships in a general sense. I don't know what your sufferings, what your pasco, to use that ancient Greek word, I don't know what they are. But listen, if God grants you suffering, do not despise it. I like what F.B. Meyer said. He wrote on this point, everyone cannot be trusted with suffering. All cannot stand the fiery ordeal. They would speak rashingly and complainingly. So the master has to select with careful scrutiny the branches that can stand the pruning knife. And so, F.B. Meyer continues, look up and take each throb of pain, each hour of agony as a gift. Dare to thank him for it. Look inside the envelope of pain for the message that it enfolds. It's a rough packing case, but there's treasure in it. God grants us to suffer for his sake. And Paul knew that their suffering was in some ways like the suffering that he had also experienced. Verse 30, having the same conflict which you saw in me and now hear in me. Now listen, if the Philippians had Paul's same kind of conflict, what does that tell you? They could also have Paul's same kind of joy that he has right now. And so can us. So can we. We recognize that God is master over our life. That there's no trial that comes to us except through the hands of God. And it doesn't mean that God necessarily wants you to remain in the trial. Maybe it's his will to deliver you out of it. But the presence of the trial shouldn't discourage you to thinking that God has abandoned you one bit. Not any more than God had abandoned Paul in that Philippian jail.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. there's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.